Blog Talk Radio.
That's Lady Gaga and Bad Romance. We are going to talk about a bad romance tonight. Good Tuesday evening. It is 8 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S., and that means it's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser. I'm Steve Laser, and I thank you for deciding to spend part of your evening with me. We've got a packed show today. We're going to start off discussing our ongoing coverage of the fiscal cliff issue and how various folks on both sides are approaching it. Then, the bad romance itself, the Petraeus scandal, and how it relates to Benghazi. After that, we're going to talk about how Arizona still has a lot of ballots to be counted and how that might affect races there. Then, marijuana legalization and the war on drugs. And finally, secession is afoot. At any time during the show, if you want to call in and talk with me, please do so. The call-in number for the show is 917-889-3891. So let's dive right into the news with the question of averting the fiscal cliff. In case you haven't heard, the fiscal cliff refers to a number of laws which, if unchanged, would result in a number of tax increases, spending cuts, and reduction in the budget deficit. That's a good thing. Starting January 1st, 2013. One of the big anxieties about the cliff, though, is that various organizations like the Congressional Budget Office has determined that the combination of across-the-board tax increases and spending cuts would cause a recession if allowed to go into effect. Now, the architect behind the Republican Party pledge that virtually all Republican Party candidates sign not to raise taxes, that's Mr. Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform, spoke on Sunday with the folks at Newsmax, and he was asked about whether taxes would be raised on the wealthy. And he responded, quote, "I think you look back to 2 years ago, you had a Democratic president, Democratic Senate, and a Republican Congress coming in. What did they do? The president huffed and puffed and threatened to blow the whole thing up and demanded higher taxes on people who work on Saturdays, and he agreed to extend all the Bush tax cuts for another 2 years." Norquist went on to say, "So now we're 2 years later, we have a Republican House and a Democratic president and Democratic Senate. I think they'll do exactly what they did 2 years ago, extend the Bush tax cuts out 2 years." So basically, Norquist is pushing this idea that the same agreement reached 2 years ago and last year, because we also had budget negotiations last year. So essentially, the same agreements are going to be reached again, and we're going to extend the Bush tax cuts. Of course, Norquist likes that idea because it means no tax increases on the wealthy. And that's really what Norquist is about. That's who funds his organization. That's what he's out there trying to ensure doesn't happen. No tax increases on the wealthy. The interviewer then asked Mr. Norquist whether he thought that Republicans and Democrats could work together and reach a deal, to which Norquist said something pretty extraordinary, rude, and untrue all at the same time. Let's listen.
But you did ask another question. Do I believe when the president says he wants to be bipartisan, nonpartisan, work with others? The answer is, it's like when somebody tells you that they want to lose weight, but they've never done it before, or they want to run the marathon, but they've never done it before. They might mean it, but we don't know because they've never done it before. Obama's gotten to be pretty old, and he has gray hair, and he's never sat down and civilly talked to people who don't agree with him in his life.
Never civilly sat down and talked to people who disagree with him in his life. This is actually a familiar lie told by Republicans over the last 4 years. Republicans have carefully cultivated this idea that President Obama doesn't negotiate, that he's arrogant, that he always tries to get his own way. That's the spin Republicans have been telling the American people for the last 4 years. Hold on to that thought, and let's listen to two sound bites from the Republican leaders in the House and Senate, respectively. This is Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell from the budget and tax negotiations a year ago.
"So I'm comfortable we're not going to raise taxes coming out of this joint committee.
I'm also highly optimistic that we'll be able to get the kind of entitlement reform that we could not get in negotiation with the president. Just to take you back to these discussions I've been in for the last couple of months, the price for major entitlement reform with this president was a big tax increase. That will not happen in this joint committee. And if the president is presented with a bill that's passed both the House and Senate, I think there's zero chance he would veto it.
Think about what Mitch McConnell just admitted there. The president was willing to negotiate serious entitlement reform if he got tax increases on the wealthy. But the Republicans, in this case specifically Mitch McConnell, refused to negotiate on the tax side. Now let's listen to what John Boehner said the day after Election Day. This is 6 days ago. The Speaker of the House, Republican John Boehner.
Raising tax rates is unacceptable. Raising tax rates will slow down our ability to create the jobs that everyone says they want.
So now we have Speaker Boehner saying flat out that he is unwilling to negotiate on raising tax rates. What was it that Grover Norquist was just saying about not civilly sitting down and negotiating with people who disagree with you? We just heard the senior Republicans in the House and Senate flat out say they're not going to negotiate on raising taxes. Who's the problem in these negotiations? I know who Grover Norquist is trying to say the problem is. I know who the rest of the Republicans are trying to say the problem is. But this isn't even a question that takes some time to think about. The senior Republicans on the Hill have admitted on multiple occasions that they aren't willing to negotiate on a major part of the puzzle. There's no question to be argued. This is fact. The problem, and the folks unwilling to negotiate with people who disagree with them, are the Republicans. Now, there are three lessons here that Republicans have not learned from election 2012. First lesson is that a majority of the American people do not buy the lies Republicans tell about the president. They don't believe the lie that he is a Muslim. They don't believe the lie that he was born in Kenya. And they don't believe that he is unwilling to negotiate, and they don't believe he's the problem in budget and tax negotiations. Wonder why. The Republicans are always admitting they're not willing to negotiate. That's why. The second lesson from the election that Norquist, McConnell, and Boehner better learn is that the American people want taxes raised on the wealthy. A CBS News exit poll on Election Day yielded the result that 13% of voters indicated they supported raising taxes on everyone, and 47% of voters expressed a desire to increase income taxes, increase income taxes on the wealthy. If we add those voters together, 60% of the country wants taxes raised on the wealthy. That's a significant majority. The third lesson that Republicans better get with the program on is that the American people want results, and they expect Republicans and Democrats and President Obama to work together to come up with a solution that prevents the country from going over the fiscal cliff and starts simultaneously producing more jobs. They don't want ideologically driven roadblocks. The American people want progress. Now, there's some good news on this front. CNN reported on Sunday that Republican Senator Bob Corker conceded that wealthy Americans should pay more in taxes, but that the increase should come by closing loopholes rather than raising tax rates. The Tennessee Republican said cuts to entitlement spending would also need to be on the table for Republicans to agree to a deal. Now, this CNN article also went on to say that on Friday, President Obama repeated his demand that tax rates on incomes over $250,000 should be allowed to increase. That puts him at odds with members of the GOP leadership, including, of course, we just heard him say it, House Speaker John Boehner, who has maintained a hardline opposition to any tax increase, but also says, just like Corker said, that he is open to revenue-boosting changes to the tax code, like closing loopholes. Senator Corker said that the difference between the president and the GOP House were not insurmountable. Now, will we get a deal? folks, I got to say, in my estimation, this could go either way. But if we don't get a deal, it will be because the Republicans were unwilling to deal on one or more issues. That much is certain. President Obama should take his case directly to the American people. If negotiations fail, he should put together his best proposal, his most fair proposal, and he should send it to the LA Times, the New York Times, the Miami Herald, all the major newspapers and say, this is what I was willing to do. Republicans weren't willing to sign on. On to General Petraeus and Benghazi. Well, the General Petraeus story continues to evolve and become more sordid, seemingly with every passing minute. It turns out the reason the general's affair was discovered in the first place has to do with a jealous girlfriend. The girlfriend in question, Paula Broadwell, who's a former military officer, and of course it's come out that she is Petraeus' biographer, had been sending anonymous harassing emails to another woman who she thought was a romantic rival. The harassing email started in June of this year and warned the woman in question, Petraeus' family friend Jill Kelly, that her advances toward Petraeus would have to stop or she would be subjected to some sort of retaliation. Now, Jill Kelly, it should be pointed out, has consistently denied that any sort of affair exists between or improper relationship exists between her and General Petraeus. She's married, and as of now, nobody is saying for sure that any kind of affair took place between her and the general. Now, in one version of the story, says that in response to the emails, Kelly contacted the FBI, and this started a chain of events that would lead to the affair between Petraeus and Broadwell being discovered. FBI investigators then traced the emails to Broadwell, and in going through her emails, they discovered the romantic emails she had sent to and received from Petraeus. Not really sent and received, and I'll explain that in a moment. But they were communicating. The reason this was an issue involving national security is that the way Petraeus and Broadwell tried to conceal their relationship was they left emails in each other's email accounts in draft mode. Okay? In other words, the two paramours had each other's username and password to their email accounts. That's where the problem comes in. In terms of national security and national secrets, no one should have the usernames and passwords to the email accounts of the head of the CIA. That's obvious, right? Now, in the last 24 hours, the story has gotten even better, if you can use that word. Apparently, there are suggestive emails to Jill Kelly from another general, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General John Allen. Now, Allen is currently under investigation for sending inappropriate emails to Kelly, including alleged emails that contain pictures of him without a shirt on. Now, some people say that it was the investigation into those emails from General Allen that caused everything else to be discovered and that it was not Jill Kelly who contacted the FBI. I guess we'll find out for sure how this all went down in the coming days. But, folks, I have to say, the political aspect of this to me is that if not for the desire by Republicans to try and find something to hurt or impeach President Obama with, as I described during Sunday's episode, the Petraeus story is a 3 to 5 day one at most. It's the Republicans who have blown this up to try to suggest that he was fired because, you know, the president's trying to hide something regarding Benghazi. And that's really what has blown the story up into what it's become. And even though we've now heard how this has all come about, Republicans are still desperately trying to spin this as a resignation that happened to protect the president regarding Benghazi. It's hard to imagine how Republicans figure this one, since Petraeus is a Republican, appointed by George W. Bush. To his first command in Iraq, and would simply need to just talk to whoever he needs to talk to in order to expose wrongdoing if he needed to do so. In fact, now that he's no longer employed by the CIA, he doesn't even have a job to protect. Now, I mentioned earlier, I described what happened in Benghazi in some detail during my Sunday show. Not only is there nothing impeachable there, it's hard to find someplace where the administration made any kind of major mistake at all, before, during, or after the attacks. I think we can also put to bed any suggestion that what happened wasn't big enough to cause Petraeus' resignation in terms of his affair. I mean, various pundits, when this all first came out, and that includes David Gergen, Peggy Noonan among them, said that they couldn't understand why Petraeus was resigning as the result of a simple affair. Remember that, when that first came out? Well, this is now clearly not a simple affair. It's huge. It's drawn many different players and issues into it, and has definite questions of national security and the network access credentials of people with access to sensitive national security matters. Now, one of the things that I think bears watching is the notification timetable aspect of this situation. It appears, for instance, that Congressman Eric Cantor was the first major political figure notified, and that he was notified far in advance of, for instance, Dianne Feinstein. She's the chairwoman and highest-ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. You would think that something to do with the CIA, she should know before Eric Cantor. Eric Cantor knew before President Obama, it seems. It appears that Cantor was notified by an FBI employee on October 27th. 11 days before the election. That timing is pretty suspicious to me. Cantor then notified FBI Director Robert Mueller through Cantor's chief of staff, but Cantor says he did not inform anyone else. Now, what's curious is, why did this FBI employee go to Cantor instead of the director of the FBI? The main question that I have about that is, the follow-up question is, did that FBI employee hope that one of the most senior Republicans in the House could use this issue politically in the election? Now, anyone who's been an executive or in management in any organization who hears this story can probably imagine how FBI Director Mueller probably reacted to the idea that one of his employees informed someone outside of his organization, a powerful congressman, instead of telling him. I think the Senate hearing on this whole matter needs to include testimony from that FBI employee, for sure. Now, one of the other interesting things about the Benghazi and Petraeus issue is how some of the pundits are approaching them. Many of the pundits who have been around for a while are on record with their reactions to the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. One of them, David Gergen, someone who is usually pretty consistent and level-headed, served in both Democratic and Republican administrations, seems to have a bit of a consistency issue here. I should also note that Mr. Gergen was a friend of both General Petraeus and Paula Broadwell. Now, in regards to this issue, he opined, and I quote, "Great men have affairs, and that those relationships can be very important to them in difficult times. I would hope people would remember that there have been other great leaders in this country. Remember President Eisenhower when he was General Eisenhower, Kay Summersby, how important that relationship was to him." And Gergen went on to say, "Remember Franklin Roosevelt and Lucy Mercer, how important that relationship was to him during the Second World War. I think we have to be understanding that, as the saying goes, the best of men are still men, men at their best." End quote. Now, other than specifying that his apologia was about men and should have really been about human beings, I can accept that this opinion, I can accept the opinion from Gergen if it applied to everyone fairly, right? Men, women, Democrats, Republicans, if he said that about everybody, people are people, the best of people are still people, people at their best, I could understand that. However, Mr. Gergen did not react the same way when the Monica Lewinsky affair happened. Regarding Monica Gate, Gergen said, quote, "We have our own set of village rules. Sex did not violate those rules. The deep and searing violation took place when he not only lied to the country, but co-opted his friends and lied to them. That is one on which people choke." end quote. Now, why does Petraeus get a pass from David Gergen while Clinton got such a backhanded indictment? Now, some of you are going to say, well, you know, Clinton's staff were involved and whatever. You know what? It is impossible to believe that many of Petraeus' staff were unaware of the affair. That just cannot happen with men who have scores of assistants and security and drivers and all that. Petraeus obviously involved his staff. They knew about the affair. They knew what was going on. They saw it. I'm sure they did on multiple occasions. So again, why the pass for Petraeus by Gergen? Gergen is not the only one on this. I think he can feel better that his consistency issues are certainly not the worst on Petraeus by far. Now, in my opinion, none other than Pat Robertson has the worst consistency issues on Petraeus. And that's not even regarding his opinions with Petraeus versus Clinton. It's regarding his opinion on Petraeus versus what are supposed to be his core beliefs as a Christian pastor. You won't hear me talking about religious beliefs too much on this show, but this was too much for me not to address. The Reverend Pat Robertson sought to excuse Petraeus' actions by saying, quote, "Who knows? The man's off in a foreign land, and he's lonely, and here's a good-looking lady throwing herself at him. I mean, he's a man. She's an extremely good-looking woman. She's a marathon runner. She runs Ironman triathlons. So she's out running with him and writing a biography. I think the term is you know what? I practiced saying this word. I think the term is, Robertson said, propinquity. Propinquity. Now, that's a word that you don't hear very much. I had to look it up to try to understand what it was completely that Pat Robertson was saying here. It's obvious that he's making excuses for Petraeus, but I looked it up, turned to Merriam-Webster's online dictionary for help, and according to Merriam-Webster, propinquity, that's the right pronunciation, propinquity has two definitions. The first meaning in the dictionary is nearness of blood, i.e. kinship. Now, I don't think Robertson was trying to excuse Petraeus and Broadwell's behavior by saying that they're related and engaging in incest. So I think we can rule that definition out. The only other definition listed in Merriam-Webster is nearness in place of time, i.e. proximity. So Robertson was excusing Petraeus' adultery for being geographically close to Broadwell. Well, why haven't Christian ministers said this before? It all makes sense now. Having sex outside of marriage is okay from a Christian point of view if the person is in the same general vicinity that you're in, right? It's only if you're having sex with someone who is far away that it's bad and adultery comes into play. That makes so much sense. Well, wait, no, it doesn't actually. Robertson really takes the cake when it comes to twisting Christianity to try to fit it within Republican policy or to help Republicans in general. I remember a couple of years ago Pat Robertson claiming how lower taxes are Christian. Now, I'm not going to claim to be an expert on religion, but I have read what's called the Old and New Testament cover to cover many times. I have never seen any indication by any biblical person or any biblical reference, metaphor, parable, or allegory to suggest that there is a Christian liturgy-based preference for lower taxes. Nor is there an excuse, an adultery excuse, for propinquity. Getting back to the political fallout from all of this, Senator Dianne Feinstein, chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has indicated that despite his resignation, Petraeus will be called to testify about Benghazi. I think that's a good idea. I look forward to a thorough investigation into Petraeus' resignation and the greater issue of Benghazi. I just hope that the folks on the Republican side who are desperately looking to try to make Benghazi into the next Watergate are able to deal with their disappointment when nothing nefarious turns up from anyone or regarding anyone inside the administration. Next, Arizona is still counting ballots and the outcome of various races there is still in doubt. Is Arizona's election administration worse than Florida's? You're here with Making Sense with Steve Laser. Feel free to call in if you want to talk to me, 917-889-3891. Now, at the end of last week, Election Day was Tuesday. At the end of last week, one-third of all ballots in Arizona remained uncounted. One-third. It makes you wonder how any of the networks or anybody else or the Supervisor of Elections of Arizona, for that matter, how they could determine how anyone won in that state or lost. For instance, how did they call the race for president in Arizona on Election Day if 3 days later, a third of the ballots there still weren't counted? Now, as of today, earlier when I checked, Tuesday, November 13th, Arizona has only counted 85% of all ballots. Close to 250,000 votes remain uncounted in Arizona. And that number, just so you know, is larger than the distance between President Obama and Mitt Romney in that state, which is 207,000 right now. You know, FYI, Mitt Romney has been determined to be the winner of Arizona. And it's hard to imagine that President Obama would get a large enough percentage of the remaining 250,000 votes to close a 207,000 vote gap. And it would have no bearing at all who won the presidency. But just imagine that Arizona was close and both candidates were under 270 electoral votes, but for that state. The entire country would be sitting around waiting for the results. More to that point, the election for two of Arizona's congressional districts, their second and ninth, still aren't decided. The winner in Arizona's first congressional district took several days to determine. And in reality, the races in the first and ninth districts really aren't that close. The Democratic candidate leads by 4% in the first district and 3% in the ninth. Those kinds of margins of difference should be callable on election night. And they would be if the state had an adequate process and organization to count the ballots. Now, I think there needs to be a federal investigation into the entire electoral process in Arizona. Only having counted 85% of ballots a week after Election Day is unacceptable. If you want a comparison, Florida, who people like to make jokes about, and I've done it myself, has 97% of votes counted and has four times as many people casting ballots as Arizona does. This is unacceptable. Need a federal investigation. Next up, marijuana legalization. Well, if your state doesn't have it yet, let me tell you, it's coming. One of the many interesting stories coming out of Election 2012 is the initiatives in Colorado and Washington to legalize recreational marijuana use. This isn't a veiled effort like the medical marijuana legislation that euphemistically legalized marijuana for medical use that's passed in 20 or so states. No, this is not that. Colorado and Washington passed state initiatives that legalize someone or a bunch of folks getting together and getting high. Okay? They're not pussyfooting around it. This is legal recreational marijuana use. Now, a Gallup poll last year showed that 50% of Americans now favor the legalization of marijuana for adult use. This is a massive change that we all need to come to grips with. On a personal note, I was in favor of the war on drugs for a long time. It's only in the last few years that I've come to realize that the war on drugs is bad policy. And it's bad policy for two main reasons. The first and foremost reason, it doesn't work. That's a big problem, right? It doesn't work. The war on drugs does not work. A massive amount of drugs make it into this country. And a large amount of the American people use what are legal drugs in most states. Whatever other things that you believe on this issue, if the current policy doesn't work, we need to make changes. We're spending way too much money on this policy if it doesn't work. We spent $15 billion on the war on drugs in 2010. And have spent over $1 trillion since 1970. There's a lot of other things that we could be doing with that money. Paying down the deficit, for one. The second reason the war on drugs is bad policy is that, just like with alcohol in the 1920s, the main effect of the war on drugs seems to be the proliferation and enrichment of a growing cartel of organized crime syndicates around the world. Imagine for a moment if the United States and the countries of Latin America and the rest of the world legalized all drugs tomorrow and the governments took over production, distribution, and sales. Now forget about the moral objections that you might have for a moment, and just think about what that would mean for crime. The crime syndicates here in the United States and in the rest of those countries, the rest of the world, would be destroyed overnight because they'd be cut off from any sort of income. So we have this policy that not only doesn't work to stop the trafficking or use of drugs, it enables the existence of large and violent organized crime syndicates. We spend untold billions on imprisoning nonviolent drug offenders. And, you know, this really is a no-brainer. Now, personally, I'm not in favor of the use of drugs. I've never even tried pot. I never even didn't inhale. I've given up alcohol in the last couple of years. But we have to acknowledge what's not working. We can save $15 to $20 billion a year minimum. We can use 10% of that savings and open up clinics to treat people who have become addicted, and use the rest, 90% of that $15 to $20 billion a year, to pay down the deficit. We could use the income or taxes on the drugs sold to pay down the deficit even further. And we can save the space in our jails for people who are a real risk of violence. And we can keep those violent offenders in throughout the duration of their sentences. If the vote in Colorado and Washington, and the Gallup polling is any indication, the country is ready for big changes in how we address the issue of drugs. I think it makes sense to end the war on drugs once and for all. Finally, on making sense, we have this wave of online secession petitions being promoted across a dozen or more states. Now, 4 years ago, Republicans channeled the sore losers in the extreme right of their party into taking over the libertarian tea parties and pretending that these tea parties were somehow different from what had existed all along, the far-right portion of the GOP. Now, there was nothing new about the tea party other than sound volume. Now we're supposed to be surprised that a small amount of the sore losers in the GOP are floating the idea of secession. Just so you know. And don't get concerned. The most signatures in any state so far is Texas, with somewhere between 25,000 and 30,000. So this whole idea of secession is a joke. And if anything, it's only going to amount to a bunch of folks who have publicly outed themselves as sore losers. But it raises some interesting points. The red states, which are primarily the ones that have people, a small amount of people, talking about secession right now, are net takers in terms of federal taxes. In other words, they receive more federal money into their states than people in those states pay in federal taxes. Conversely, most of the blue states are net givers. People in places like New York, California, Massachusetts, et cetera, the blue states, pay more in federal taxes than their states get in federal funding. What that means is that if you imagine the red states secede, they would need to raise taxes on their citizens by more than they're currently paying in federal taxes in order for those states just to maintain their infrastructure and services to what they are now. In order to give their citizens lower taxes than what they pay now, which seems to be their big beef and goal, they would have to drastically cut back on infrastructure and services. Again, conversely, if those states seceded, us folks in the blue states could be given an overall tax cut, and we would be able to maintain the same level of infrastructure and services we have now. In fact, if we kept taxes that we are paying the same amounts total, we would be able to improve our infrastructure and services if the red states seceded. So red staters, can't put this any more plainly than this. You need us more than we need you. 20 years after our fictional secession that I've been talking about, you would have the infrastructure of red states looking like the infrastructure of one of the more backward countries of the third world, whereas you would have high-speed rail throughout the blue states, single-payer health care, and taxes would not have to go up to pay for all that. Something to think about. Well, that's all I have for this evening. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 8 p.m. Eastern Time this Thursday, November 15th. Until then, have a great evening and great rest of your week.
Right here, it's a burn. It's too straight. Let's run that.